for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A restful, restorative night's sleep is an unattainable dream for millions of Americans. Our stressful 24/7 lifestyles are only part of the problem. Many people suffer from undiagnosed sleep disorders that not only keep them from a good night's rest, but could be putting their lives at risk. A growing body of research has found a strong connection between sleep and overall health. Joining me in the studio to talk about the science of sleep, David Neubauer of the Johns Hopkins University, Helen Enselam of the Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders, and Michael Twury of the National Institutes of Health. I know that sleep is important to all of us. I hope you'll join us. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Twitter or Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
David, I wonder if you could begin our conversation by talking about the function of sleep. What is it that happens and what do we need?
Well, it's a huge question. You know, the easy answer is that we need sleep in order to feel awake and alert and function pretty well the following daytime. And so the easiest way to answer the question is to say that if we don't get enough sleep, then we suffer in some way the following daytime. And the most obvious way then would be thinking of how our brain operates. We know that if we don't get enough sleep, we're fatigued, we feel run down, we don't concentrate so well. And that might happen to any of us acutely if we lose sleep all night long. But much more common in our society are the people who are chronically sleep deprived. Mm-hmm. Many millions of us, it seems to be the norm in our society for people not to get sufficient sleep. And we're now beginning to appreciate that the function of sleep really is much broader than simply the opposite of sleep, that is being able to promote better wakefulness. But we're appreciating the fact that there are a lot of other health connections related to sleep, especially for people who have long-term sleep deprivation.
The question of what is sufficient has long been debated. When I was growing up, I heard people say that as you grow older, you need less and less sleep. Hasn't that theory sort of gone out the window?
Pretty much. There still is debate about exactly how much sleep we need at different ages. But for the most part, you know, people in our society are not getting the amount of sleep that they truly do need. As for aging, you know, a lot of people do come in to see us, older individuals who feel that they're not getting enough sleep. And so we try to address those problems. We evaluate them thoroughly. We see the extent to which sleep disorders might be contributing to that sleep impairment. But we really don't think it's true that older people who feel they're not getting enough sleep should simply attribute it to the fact that they're aging.
David Neubauer, he's associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Turning to you, Helen Enselam, what about the differences in the needs for sleep in a young child versus, for example, a teenager? I can remember being very concerned about our son when he was a baby. He was sleeping until he was 5 months old, like 19 hours a day. I mean, some babies need that.
It's very interesting, Diane, but there's a great deal of variability in infant sleep needs, and there are far fewer hard and fast rules about how much sleep an infant needs. Providing your infant with the proper environment, trying to get them so the timing of their sleep coincides at least in part with the nighttime so you can get your own sleep is important. But there are children who require 19 hours of sleep, 12 and 14 hours of sleep, not uncommon. And we kind of go with the flow with that. One of the problems that we have is understanding what the sleep needs are for children and especially for our teenagers. Where a lot of us tend to think of teenagers as mini adults, their sleep requirements are quite different than those of adults. And the average sleep requirement from most studies that have been run for a teenager is 9.25 hours of sleep a night.
Wow. And I'll bet there aren't too many who get that.
Extremely few and far between, and not always of their own volition. I think one of the startling data points we have from the National Sleep Foundation poll in 2006 is that more than 50% of teenagers recognize that they're tired and not getting enough sleep, but parents don't always recognize that.
Helen Insulam, she's director of the Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders. She's also associate clinical professor of neurology at the George Washington University. Michael Twury, what is keeping people from getting the sleep they need? Is it primarily they're too busy to sleep, or is it that there are problems?
Diane, that's an excellent question because there is a tremendous competition today in our modern society. We, as you pointed out earlier, we have the opportunity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to engage in productivity. We can work on our problems. We can be entertained. The internet is certainly a very exciting opportunity and provides a lot of that entertainment, TV watching, and so forth. So we have whether we're looking for entertainment, whether we're shift workers, whether we're single parent, single heads of household with child responsibilities, many factors enter into the equation that competes for the 7 to 8 hours that most adults need, or more than 9 hours that adolescents may need. And I think that part of the problem is that with regard to scheduling time, saving time for sleep, is that many people don't understand just how sleep is contributing to their health, how sleep interacts with all our strands of life, how we interact and live with others, how we perceive our environment, and how it, you know, there's many aspects of how sleep erodes our health that it's not something that can be easily measured. Unlike pain and things that we can sense, we know when we have a cold. By the time we begin to feel so sleepy that we can't lift another finger and move forward, it really is a challenge.
It's too late.
The effect on our health is already, and that's the current edge for research is trying to begin to define what those interactions are. What is the effect in terms of the molecules of our body? How is it affecting our hormonal systems? Mm-hmm. A lot is known. There's a lot left to be discovered.
Now, putting aside the question of how much time we allow ourselves to sleep, what are the problems that go into helping people get a good night's sleep?
Yeah. Certainly for most everyone, the first step to think about is a daily schedule for sleep. Sleep and wakefulness, just like many have heard of the biological clock. Well, it's all about rhythms and maintaining a regular sleep schedule, going to bed at the same time, making sure that you're in a suitable sleep environment. That we don't engage in things that might stimulate us in terms of, you know, keeping us up late at night, eating large meals, being in front of bright lights, vigorous physical activities in the hours preceding bedtime are all things that help to disturb our regular cycle of sleep and wakefulness. There's also the dimension of sleep problems, and that's another topic to discuss.
Michael Twury, he's director of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research at the National Institutes of Health. I'm not surprised. Our lines are already filled with callers. We'll get to those in just a few moments. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. If you can't get through on the phone, you can post a message on Facebook or send us a tweet. Helene, would you explain for sleep apnea?
Sleep apnea is a very interesting disorder. It is a disorder that occurs at night while we're asleep, and it's a failure of our airway to stay fully open at night. So the muscles of the airway deep back behind the tongue partially close or completely close.
Now, are those the same muscles that deal with the voice?
They're adjacent to the muscles dealing with the voice, but not the identical muscles. It's the larynx, and this is mostly the pharynx. And those pharyngeal muscles have a lot of resistance in them while we're awake. I mean, you're never standing in an elevator next to somebody snoring. But when we fall asleep, as you know from your own children, if you have any, our muscles relax.
Sure.
And in obstructive sleep apnea, there's a relaxation of the pharyngeal musculature. Once the airway begins to relax, we can hear snoring in many people, although there's some who don't snore. And the airway can actually completely collapse and close, requiring usually quite a vigorous snort and an arousal to get airflow going again. And the net result of the process of obstructive sleep apnea going on at night is that individuals don't get restorative sleep. Their sleep is disturbed by snorts, and arousals, fragmenting the very important continuity of sleep, and they get tired during the day as a consequence.
Helen Enslem, she's Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders Director, and she is an Associate Professor of Neurology at George Washington University. Welcome back. We're talking about sleep, a subject precious to all of us. And we've got three experts here in the studio. Helene Enslem, she's at the Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders. David Neubauer is at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Michael Torrey is at the National Institutes of Health. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. When you've got something like sleep apnea, Michael, why is there such a connection between sleep apnea and stroke that we're hearing more and more about?
Yeah. So Helene just mentioned that one of the effects of sleep apnea is it disrupts our sleep, and that's
right.
Certainly true. But the one of the other aspects that's also important is that you're not getting enough oxygen to your lungs. And this type of this forms a stress on the body. Your body knows that you're not getting enough oxygen, and it does some things such as starting to wake you up and disturbs your sleep. But the other thing it does is it releases some stress hormones to help your body deal with the low oxygen situation. And those stress hormones tell the heart to work harder. It tells the blood vessels to contract. And this happens with every time that a sleep apnea event occurs. Every time there's difficulty getting air in into the lungs, such that our blood levels of oxygen start to drop. And if it only happened once in our lifetime or on occasion, it probably wouldn't mean much. The danger with sleep apnea is that this is something that occurs over and over again, perhaps dozens of times each hour, perhaps in some cases 50, 60, 70 times per hour. And it's this repetitive nature of this event that the body maintains this emergency state, this elevated level of stress hormones that leads to abnormalities in how our vascular system functions. So basically, instead of going back to a relaxed state after the event occurs, the body learns that it keeps occurring over and over again. And this elevated state of stress remains, it's slightly elevated throughout not just the night, but also the day. And this contributes to an increase in our blood pressure. It tells the heart to work harder. And again, over time, periods of many years, this can actually erode the health of these systems. Erode not only the health of our cardiovascular system, but also erode the health of our metabolic pathways, our ability to handle blood glucose, and lead to, again, an erosion of our health.
Does the physical structure of the neck itself and the structure of the airways, David Neubauer, does that have anything to do with whether one develops sleep apnea or not?
It certainly has a lot to do with one's vulnerability for sleep apnea. A lot of times people think that weight is the major issue, and it is very, very important because obesity, very significantly contributes to one's risk for having sleep apnea.
But which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, they probably both occur together. We see plenty of skinny people who have bad sleep apnea just because of the particular airway anatomies that they were born with. Weight simply compounds the problem. So sometimes when an obese person has bad sleep apnea and they're successful in losing weight, then there may be a disappearance of their symptoms. On the other hand, you can't count on that because many of them still have some airway vulnerability for that collapsibility.
Do we have an estimate within the American population of how many people actually suffer from sleep apnea? And do we sometimes overlook sleep apnea in the population, Michael?
So I don't think we really know just how many people have sleep apnea in the United States. What we do know is something about how many people report symptoms of sleep apnea. And with the help of the Centers for Disease Control, which organizes studies that are surveilling the health of the population, we now expect that perhaps 20 to 30% of the population the U.S. adult population is reporting problems such as frequent snoring. They report problems of excessive daytime sleepiness. They may feel sleepiness because they're not getting enough restful sleep during the night, as Helene pointed out. We also look at the relationship of these symptoms in connection with how the frequency of obesity, because as David mentioned, these factors move hand in hand.
Helene.
We are seeing clinically in our daily practice a huge iceberg effect with obstructive sleep apnea. The idea that if you're an overweight ex-football player, you're the one that's probably got obstructive sleep apnea just isn't playing out as the only risks at all. We see an enormous number of women, particularly postmenopausally, with obstructive sleep apnea who don't necessarily have the redundant tissues to make much noise at all in terms of snoring. And I always urge everyone who feels tired out there to allocate enough time for sleep, to download a sleep log from the National Sleep Foundation website or ours. Track how much sleep you're getting, and if you're still tired, see your doctor, get a good general physical, and look into the issues surrounding the potential non-restorative nature of things that might be going on with your sleep.
So talk about how you treat sleep apnea, Helene.
Well, the airway is collapsing intermittently, and as Michael pointed out, maybe 60 or 70 times an hour, and the idea is to keep the airway open. Unfortunately, your airway is used to talk, to eat, to breathe, lots of functions. We can't put a stent in it like we can in a coronary artery that's closing or a carotid artery that's closing. And one of the most effective modalities that we have for treating it is to use the air we breathe as a stent, as a means of keeping the airway open. So the device called CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure, is a machine. You have a mask that fits over your nose or a very compact nasal pillow system that fits in your nostrils, connects with tubing to a little air compressor. You're the respirator, you breathe in, and when you breathe in, it pressurizes the air just a little bit above room air pressure, just enough so that your airway can't collapse.
All right, here's our first email from Dave in Westlake, Ohio. He says, I was just diagnosed with sleep apnea. Here's the thing, he says, the idea of sleeping with a CPAP machine fills me with dread. But my snoring, the reason I got checked in the first place, is having a negative impact on my wife. What can I do to help without CPAP? For what it's worth, I wake feeling rested in the morning. David?
I think probably the best thing to do is address the fear of the CPAP rather than trying to find an alternative to it. CPAP is a very effective treatment for most patients with sleep apnea. And admittedly, you know, it's awkward to think about sleeping with this mask strapped around your face. But in fact, you know, most people with sleep apnea do well with it and sleep much better and function with greater alertness and greater safety as well during the following daytime. So many people take to it right away. On the other hand, there are some who need more encouragement and hand-holding, and it's really a very small group that end up not being able to tolerate it at all in the
end. And we've heard lots from that very small group who feel very strongly that that device somehow is fearsome.
Very important to try to wrap your head around the idea, read about it, understand what it's doing. If somebody just hands you a CPAP machine, it's very hard to say, oh, I'd love to just sleep with this tonight. But we encourage patients to understand why they're doing it. If your mask is bothering you, if your nasal pillow systems are irritating you, there are over 45 different devices out there that we can use to deliver pressure. And your bed partner is going to love you all that much more that they're getting their sleep, because your snoring, your awakening at night disturbs the quality of their sleep.
All right. Now, take the person who is snoring but, say, does not have sleep apnea. I mean, is snoring a normal part of sleep or not? Michael.
So when we talk about snoring and sleep apnea, what we're really talking about is that loud, chronic snoring that tends to disturb, it's loud enough to disturb others around, and also where it occurs with regularity. It, you know, the soft purring sounds of sleep are not something that's associated with either cardiovascular risk or subsequent burden
of
sleeping.
But then you've got to have a decibel count, don't you?
This is one of the interesting aspects about sleep apnea. There's a lot of conditions where you're aware that you have the condition, right? I mean, whether it's pain, restless leg syndrome, these things are you can be aware of. In the case of sleep apnea, the person who's affected often has no idea of just how severe it is, and they have no means. So this is where we come back to Helene's point, that if you feel that you're not getting enough sleep, that you're sleeping during the day and it's a burden to you, or someone tells you that your snoring is disturbing them, this is where it's important for that individual to go back to their physician and discuss their symptoms, because their physician can look at their total health situation and decide whether further studies and treatment is needed.
So what happens when an individual comes to a sleep disorder clinic, Helene?
Well, I always tell my patients, don't worry. We have a nice cave back there. There are candles, howling wolves, and everything will really be okay. You know, most sleep laboratories these days are really designed to look like a nice hotel room. There is a small monitoring camera where we're really looking to confirm body position or any abnormal behaviors
at
night.
But aren't you wired up a lot?
There are wires on your scalp. It's amazing what we can do to monitor things on the other side of the planet, but inside the room we still need wires to pick up microvolts of activity. Patients are always surprised at how well they actually sleep in the sleep lab environment. We usually take a lot of time. Sleep techs are really good people who are interested in patient care. They tend to relax the patient. But there are electrodes, small wires attached to the scalp to monitor brainwave activity, next to the eyes to monitor when you're in rapid eye movement sleep, on the limbs to pick up extraneous limb movements. We monitor EKG, and there's also usually a finger probe so that we have continuous readout of oxygenation. And it is not a perfect night, so we have normal sleep lab sleep, but people do in fact sleep better than they expect.
Helene Insulam, and she is Associate Professor of Neurology at George Washington University. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here is an email from someone who clearly has been through a lot. It's from Donovan, who says, I asked my doctor to help me with a snoring problem. The results, severe sleep apnea. But instead of the mask, I went online and bought a self-molding mouthpiece from Canada. They are illegal to be over the counter in the U.S. The mouthpiece holds my jaw forward when I sleep and solves my problem. My outlay, $25. My doctors were of no help. It seems the medical profession invented the crisis of sleep apnea, but is ignoring reasonable alternatives. What do you think, Michael? Do you know about this device?
We're very familiar. There's actually, so CPAP, the use of this positive airway pressure device,
right,
is certainly a mainstay of medical treatment.
Okay.
It's because it does work. It
costs $2,000,
The devices of that type, there's many variations, but can cost several thousand dollars.
Right.
And that is certainly one of the barriers, but it does work. It gets air to your lungs, the oxygen to your lungs. There are many other devices that can adjust such as move the jaw or the tongue forward. And help to keep airway obstruction from occurring. What I would point out is important for individuals to work with their physicians on this, because sometimes the airway obstruction can be very complicated. And it can occur at different levels. It may be occurring not just at the level of the tongue, at the back of the mouth, but it could occur lower down in the airway. And some of these devices may not correct all the problems. And so the key point is, is their sleep being still disturbed by untreated apnea that's left? And are they getting enough oxygen to their blood? And by working with their physicians, they may be able to find out whether their particular condition is being treated adequately.
Helene.
The other thing to understand is that when we're dealing with severe obstructive sleep apnea, the statistical probability that an adjustment of the jaw forward with one of the dental appliances, that will sufficiently treat the apnea to a point that we've reduced the long-term stroke risks and heart disease risks, is significantly lower than with the CPAP device. So we tend to recommend the use of dental jaw advancement appliances for mild apnea, and occasionally for mild to moderate apnea. And it's extremely important to go back in and be restudied with your appliance to be sure that it is doing what you want it to do.
But doesn't it make sense to at least begin with something that's somewhat less expensive, because there are an awful lot of people who have called and written already who said they cannot tolerate the CPAP device. Doesn't it make sense to begin with perhaps something slightly less expensive? Michael.
So I think the situation here is that when someone finally comes to their doctor and says, I'm really broken.
Suffering.
I'm suffering here. This person is usually at that point in time, once we had determined that it may be sleep apnea, you know, a tremendous risk of in terms of their own safety and safety to others. And it's important to get them an effective treatment as quickly as possible, particularly, you know, if their vocation were to depend on transportation.
But if they're not going to wear it, that's a problem. We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we'll open the phones. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. At FordFoundation.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month. On the web at AECF.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Richard Clark, the former anti-terrorism czar who warned about the terrorist threat before 9/11, is now warning about cyber war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Clark about what a full-scale cyber attack could look like, why we're vulnerable, and what we can do about it. It's the subject of his new book. Join us.
Welcome back. It's time to open the phones. We'll go to Karen, who's in Frederick, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question, well, an issue that concerns my daughter.
Sure.
More. And she lives in St. Louis, and I'm here in Frederick. But anyway, she told me last week, she said, Mom, I have insomnia, and I said, how many hours of sleep a night do you get? And she said, between 3 and 4 hours. She holds down a full-time job. She is carrying 6 classes. She's going into the medical field, and she's also has a 16-month-old baby. And I'm concerned. I said, what do you do? Just get up in the middle of the night? She goes, well, I rarely go to bed. I sit in my chair and I study and I read. And I'm concerned about her, not only her safety, but when she's behind the wheel and has that baby in the car. is this normal? I mean,
I would question that.
Sure, that doesn't sound normal at all, but it really highlights the fact that when people suffer from insufficient sleep, whether it's insomnia, which is a disorder when people really have the opportunity to be sleeping but they're not, or the multitude of external influences that she describes in her daughter with, you know, caring for young children and being busy studying and just not having the proper environment to be sleeping, you know, all of that is an equation for bad sleep and therefore a bad functioning during the daytime, with the extreme example being what she mentioned, you know, being so sleepy that possibly could cause a traffic accident.
Well, it's very difficult when Karen, the mother, is here in Frederick and her daughter is in St. Louis to try to help that. But perhaps, Karen, you could send her a CD of this show or ask her to listen online. Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Bronwyn in St. Louis. Please talk about whether you can catch up on lost sleep through naps, sleeping late after a bad night, etc. My husband wakes up many times at night, goes to the bathroom, feels antsy, can't lie still. He has restless leg syndrome, frequent body twitching when he's asleep and snores loudly. He feels he catches up with naps during the day or by sleeping late, but I don't buy it. I worry all this activity is bad for his long-term health. He's napping right now because he had a bad night last night, and I wanted to listen to you. Helene.
Well, you can catch up some on sleep with naps, but it doesn't replace good quality nocturnal sleep. And if one is napping late in the day, it may make it harder to fall asleep at the proper time and get an adequate amount of sleep later at night. We like naps to be limited to 20 to 30 minutes. And if his sleep is disrupted by snoring and twitching, we have a real question about how much sleep apnea is there. There's an overlap between apnea symptoms and snoring and limb twitching. And I would be quite concerned about the possibility of a significant level of underlying apnea if he's sleepy enough to be napping in the morning.
All right. To Lafayette, Indiana. To Courtney. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a former middle school teacher, so I know all too well how often adolescents don't get the sleep that they need. But out here we have county schools that start pretty early at about 7:30 a.m., and there are some students coming from the more rural parts who have to get on the bus as early as 6:30 in the morning. And I have heard, and I don't have anything to substantiate this, and it's what I'm hoping your guests will be able to do, that we're doing the kids a disservice by starting that early, that aside from them, you know, maybe not getting to bed early enough at night, that there's actually some kind of rhythm to their body that gets disrupted by getting them up that early, and that that's a thing they're learning.
You're absolutely right. The sleep of adolescents is significantly different than that of adults. Adolescents experience a relative shift in the timing of their sleep to a later start time and a later wake-up time. They accumulate sleepiness slower during the day, and they are physiologically night owls associated with puberty, and it gets worse as we track it from 8th grade through 12th grade. So when we have schools starting at 7:30 in the morning and we have sports after school and homework and AP classes and all the pressures that kids have and jobs, they just do not have enough time to get that 9 1/4 hours of sleep that they need. And I believe we are doing a disservice politic to change.
Now, when you say it would be politic to change, would that mean you're implying that students learn better a little later in the morning than they do earlier in the morning?
Well, it's a combination of factors. Certainly, they will learn better a little bit later in the morning, but they will more especially learn better because they will have gotten more sleep and therefore be more attentive.
All right, and good luck to you, Courtney. Here's an email from, let's see, an anonymous user, sleeping pills versus lack of sleep. She says, I understand long-term use of sleeping pills can be harmful. Which is the least harmful, lack of sleep or sleeping pills? How do you respond, Michael?
So this is a very interesting question because it affects just large portions of the population. We know that sleeping pills or hypnotic drugs, as they're called, are simply one of the tools available to physicians to help us get back on a regular rhythm of mm-hmm. sleep and wakefulness. And there's many tools that are available. That is just one. And physicians, again, this is important where the patient and the physician will discuss, you know, what is the best course of action based on the history, you know, as to which set of tools, whether behavioral tools. There's also other treatments and sleep schedules that can help people wake up. Or whether hypnotic drugs are needed to help that process along.
So a number of callers are asking David about Ambien versus Lunesta versus Sonata versus natural remedies.
Well, with regard to natural remedies, there's not too much evidence that they seem to make a significant difference, at least for most people who take them. The FDA has approved a wide variety of medications for the treatment of insomnia. They go back to the category known as the benzodiazepines, the things that people may be familiar with, like Dalamane or Halcyon or brand names that would fall into those categories. But the more recent generation are the ones like Zolpidem, which is Ambien. And the other ones that the caller mentioned, Lunesta and Sonata being those brand names. They overlap quite a bit in their functioning, and they have different durations of action. So it's good for doctors to have choices if, in fact, they're going to prescribe a medication. There are a number of other medications that the FDA has approved that have different characteristics. Rosarum is the brand name for Remeltion that works through melatonin receptors. The FDA just last month approved a very low-dose version of the old tricyclic antidepressant doxepin for the treatment of insomnia. Mm-hmm. So there are many choices available for
you
us.
You have to work with the doctor.
Right.
Is the point. Helene.
Yeah, and especially, just to take that one step further, to be extremely cautious if you are going to use any of these medications for sleep, that you not combine them with alcohol, that you not combine them with other over-the-counter medications such as Benadryl, and that you allocate at least 7 to 8 hours of time before you get behind the wheel of a car.
All right, to Pontiac, Michigan. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Okay, I have sleep apnea, and I've been on the machine for 3 months now, but I don't notice any longer duration in my sleep. I sleep about an average of 5.8 hours a night, and I was wondering, should I see longer sleep durations? I'm dreaming more, not all the time, but and I'm not. My body used to ache and be sore. And now I don't have those aches and sores in my achy body in the morning when I get up. So what should I be expected to see?
Sounds as though he's making progress. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, so treating the sleep apnea is a very important step. Remember, you're helping your body get enough oxygen while you sleep. So this is an important starting point. But it doesn't mean that it's the only problem that you may have while you're sleeping. And this is, again, where you need to work with your physician, because there are so many possibilities that can contribute to sleep disturbance, whether it be other drugs or other conditions. And your physician's in the best position to sort out those possibilities.
All right. Good luck to you, Chris, and to Mary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm one of those crazy, crazy Americans who have to work overnight hours. And because of that, I'm forced to sleep in shifts. So my question to your experts are, is it all right to sleep in shifts if I have a total of 8 to 9 hours a night? Or should I just try and suck it up and go to bed after this program.
David.
Well, there's usually some compromise involved when people are doing different kinds of shift work. Getting enough sleep is the most important thing, but it's hard to achieve because our circadian rhythms promote sleepiness at nighttime and wakefulness during the daytime. And so even though we think that most people naturally should be able to get about 8 hours of sleep or so, when people are up all night, usually they're not able to go to bed the following morning and be able to sustain sleep for 8 hours because we really don't have the natural biological rhythms to help support that. So there are a lot of things that people do, including, you know, finding a good dark room and making sure that phones are unplugged or there are people who are not interfering with their sleep during the daytime.
And here's a good follow-up to that from Esther, who is a longtime night shift worker, a nurse. She says, I don't get adequate sleep during the day. Studies have shown the reduced length of life for night shift workers, as well as studies showing increase in errors when tired. Sometimes I'm so tired at work, I fall asleep on my break for 15 to 20 minutes. Does this nap help or hinder in regards to health? Helene.
Well, for the chronic night shift worker, it's extremely important to try to maintain a schedule. And having a break at night and taking a 15-minute to 20-minute nap in the beginning of the shift and toward the end of the shift is important. Also very important that people who work nights maintain a regular day schedule as well. And there are medications to treat their alertness at night that are FDA approved that are important.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Andy in Rockville, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I am a sleep apnea patient, and I am working with a sleep physician. And I'm really concerned that your guests are downplaying the difficulty of using the CPAP. I tried the CPAP for several months, different masks, different nasal pillows, and I never found it tolerable. And my sleep physician agreed that many people, not a few, as it sounded to me your guests were saying, many people have difficulty tolerating it. I've tried the dental appliance, but it messes up my jaw muscles. So I'm wondering if they've ever tried to sleep with a CPAP machine before you pass judgment on how easy it is to use, because it's not. And I'm wondering if they know of any other options
Helene.
For sleep apnea.
Well, I actually got tired of telling patients they should use this, and if they just wrap their head around the idea, they can cope. I have a machine next to my bed. When a new mask comes out, I sleep with it for the night. I get my own sense for how that mask works and how it goes. There are a lot of bells and whistles on a machine that can really help you with it. There are people who are going to find it harder to adapt to this device than others, and sometimes using a medication to help with sleep itself can help coping.
Michael.
Yeah, so breathing with machine is never going to be a natural experience, okay?
Yeah.
But I think it's important that breathing is also important and natural to accomplish. And so this is a treatment to prevent much more serious conditions. And sometimes understanding all the implications of not getting enough oxygen, can help motivate us to pursue it. I also sleep with a CPAP mask, and it does take a long time, and there's a countless barrage of this is an area of our economy where the providers of this equipment have used tremendous ingenuity and will continue to work to try to provide suitable face masks for everyone.
One other problem we haven't talked about is sleepwalking, which an awful lot of people may do on various types of medication, and you've got to be really careful of that, David.
Well, it's certainly true that the risk for complex behaviors during sleep that might include sleepwalking, or people feel that they might even be driving in their sleep and getting up and eating, those are increased with the sedating medications, and the hypnotics approved by the FDA have that warning in the labels. On the other hand, the vast majority of people that we see who do these peculiar things during the night are not on any medications at all, so it's a pretty well-known type of parasomnia disorder associated with sleep where there's abnormal behaviors.
And one last email, this a little bit on the fun side. Could you please tell my boss that I do need more than 5 hours of sleep a night, and all the work I'm required to take home is killing me? Perhaps you've got to have a talk with your boss. Thank you all so much for joining us. David Neubauer, Helene Anselm, Michael Twury. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.